Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Today's time, as always, this time on a Sunday for the Sunday Paper Review. And I should say, as well as being live on News Talk and on the OTB Sports app, we are streaming live right now as well across the OTB social channels. So we're live on youtube.com/offtheball, facebook.com/offtheball, and Periscope. So good afternoon to you wherever you're watching or listening in to from 53106, as always, for the text number. And we'll be joined in just a moment by the RTE commentator and presenter of the Hamilton Scores on Lyric FM as well. I should mention George Hamilton and Rory O'Connor, the chief rugby correspondent with Independent News and Media. I'll quickly run you through the headlines on the back pages first, though, and no surprise, what dominates the headlines on the back pages this morning and this afternoon. The Irish Mail on Sunday goes with best to last. Ferocious Ireland obliterate England to go out on a high. Ireland head coach Andy Farrell hailed his players after they delivered the most comprehensive performance of his tenure with a resounding 32-18 demolition of England in Dublin yesterday. And a bit of a worrying story for Stephen Kenny. He can't really catch a break, can he? Kenny injury woes mount ahead of Serb tie. Callum O'Dowda and Conor Hourihan have joined a growing list for the injury list for the Republic of Ireland ahead of this week's World Cup qualifiers. O'Dowda, playing for Bristol City, left the pitch in tears in the final minutes of his side's 2-0 loss to Rotherham, while midfielder Conor Hourihan limped off with a knee problem in the first half of Swansea's 1-0 home loss to Cardiff City. And Hourihan has been in incredible form for Swansea City, so a double whammy there for Stephen Kenny if in fact they can't make it back in time for that game with Serbia on Wednesday. The sports section of the Sunday Times goes with happy ending. Ireland and Stander sign off with Six Nations with demolition of England. And it's fair to say it was a bit of a demolition. The scoreline probably looked a little bit kinder for England after they got those couple of late tries. Pain in Paris in the top right hand corner. Agony for Wales as Grand Slam slips from grasp in last play of France game. And at the bottom, Wijnaldum on his way to Barcelona in the summer. So Jorginho Wijnaldum has chosen to leave Liverpool at the end of the season to join Barcelona. The Sunday Times understands the Holland international has agreed a pre-contract deal to become the first signing of Joan Laporta's second spell as president of the Catalan club. On the back page of the Sunday Independent, the new look Sunday Independent sports section, it should be said as well, Ireland deliver for Stander. Emotions run high as England are swept aside in CJ's swan song. So a great photo there of Jack Conan and Bundiaki celebrating during that 32-18 win. And a quick mention of a couple of the stories we'll get into as well. In the inside pages, Paul Kimmage, little things can mean the most. And Eamon Sweeney, remarkable Rachel Blackmore rides into history at Cheltenham. Some of the tabloids as well. The Sun, the Irish Sun on Sunday. We have Better Believe It. We knew we had this in us. Now you'd better believe it. Ireland 32, England 18. Beyond belief, Wales lose Grand Slam in injury time. Gun show, Pep, toughest test. Pep Guardiola hailing Manchester City's heart as they stayed on the quadruple trail that after Everton, they beat Everton by 2-0 in the FA Cup quarterfinals yesterday. Brighton beating Newcastle by 3-0 as well. And a good story on Manchester United as well, eyeing up a potential £50 million plus summer move for the Wolves star Pedro Neto. And a quick mention of the injury doubts for Conor Hourihan and Callum O'Dowda. The back page of the Sunday People has Van Dijk versus Klopp, an interesting story for Liverpool fans here. Anfield duo on collision course over defenders' Euro comeback plan. That Van Dijk wants to play in the Euros for Holland this summer, but Jurgen Klopp wants him to give the pre-season a whack with his club instead on his return from injury later on in this summer. Quick mention of the FA Cup quarterfinal win for Man City yesterday, and Rash set to miss out on Three Lions. Marcus Rashford could be out of England's 2022 World Cup qualifiers if he misses today's FA Cup quarterfinal at Leicester. That game getting underway at 5 p.m. at the King Power. The Sunday World as well. Flight of the Earls, that could be the tab of the day. Ireland victory launched by a brilliant sidestep from Classy Keith. Johnny Sexton believes Ireland's crushing of England can set a standard that can fire them back towards rugby's summit. More the merrier, Jose will get whopping £30 million if he's fired. Tottenham facing a crippling bill in excess of £30 million if they decide to sack Jose Mourinho. He's under siege, of course, after that Europa League exit midweek. Rangers facing a UEFA rap. Rangers midfielder Glenn Camara facing accusations of assault, with UEFA now investigating his explosive racism row with a Slavia Prague player during the week. Rangers currently 1-1 away to Celtic, 82 minutes played at Parkhead in that game. The back page then of this afternoon's Sport Star on Sunday has Gunderful. City's quad bid steps up a gear with spot in semi. More coverage of that win for Man City over Everton yesterday in the FA Cup. Leeds legend Peter Lorimer dies at the age of 74. Really sad news that broke yesterday. Leeds have lost a number of their legends from the Donrevy squad. A lot of players that John Giles of this parish would have played with and known very well and been friendly with over the years. Euro fight, story of Virgil van Dijk's potential battle with Jurgen Klopp, and the Marcus Rashford injury story as well. Nearly finished on the back pages as well. The Observer has a lovely photo of Keith Earls in full flight from yesterday. Green machine. 14-man Ireland heap pressure on Eddie Jones after England suffered their third defeat in the Six Nations. And the back page of the Sunday Mirror has that Virgil van Dijk story as well. The Irish injury story for Callum O'Dowda and for Conor Hourihan. And the last stand, Farrell Hill's fitting finale for CJ after England are ripped apart. And I think that's a fair way to put it. But George Hamilton and Rory O'Connor are on the line for the paper review this afternoon. Afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon to you, Shane.
I think we have to start with that. I was listening to yourself, George, on Lyric there, playing a bit of music. I think it was from Kathleen Ferrier. And while it was playing in the background, there was a lovely montage of Ireland against England yesterday. It was like watching something out of a Tarantino film. The lovely, peaceful music mixed in with this monstrosity of a performance from Ireland yesterday. It was quite an incredible win, to say the least.
It was. I thoroughly enjoyed it. I'm sure everybody with a green heart certainly enjoyed it too. The piece of music was Du Bist Die Ruhe, which is You Are Rest in Peace by Franz Schubert. And it was a long way from that on the pitch of the Aviva yesterday. That Keith Earls stands out as the most monumental moment of all. That had me actually jumping up out of my seat. It was just incredible what they managed to achieve off the back of that lineout. And it was a performance that I don't think too many would have seen coming, because it's been such a stop-start kind of a season. And question marks about Andy Farrell and where he's taken the team. And then all of a sudden, I don't know where this happens. And even with the 14 men, they managed to obliterate England, basically. And I love the Sunday Independent headline, Ireland deliver for standard. Well, they certainly stood and delivered yesterday.
Rory, you were at the game yesterday, and like CJ Stander spoke at full time about the fact that, you know, if fans had been there at half time, the ovation they would have got leaving that pitch after that 40 minutes of rugby would have been, you know, hair standing up at the back of your neck kind of stuff. It must have been a strange experience to be there, to be one of the lucky few that managed to be in attendance for such a big game with absolutely zero fans.
Yeah, I really hope that was the last Ireland game I have to cover with no fans at it. Their next home game, we hope, will be in November. And hopefully by then we'll have at least some fans. And George, I'm sure, experienced this in Tala on Friday night. It's just, even it's so strange in the ground. It doesn't get any more normal every time you go. Being able to park outside, the empty streets, the silence. That like they played around the Vian with a kind of a crowd backing, so you could kind of, it felt like, you know, it was designed to, so the players had some element of realism. But between Ireland's call, that and Ireland's call, they didn't have them blended together, so it just goes to complete silence, and then into Ireland's call again with kind of this crowd noise, and then that's followed by silence again as the players do their final bit of warm up. And it's incredible that they managed to reach the levels of intensity they do without anyone there to watch them, because all you really can hear is three or four people along the sideline. You can hear the commentators. I'm sure that even they can hear the commentators, even though they're up in the fifth tier of the stadium, you know, at the highest possible point. And it really, really was a game. And like Wales and France last night, they both deserve to be seen by people live in the stadium. The Six Nations has been remarkably good, considering there's been no one there to watch it. And it's probably delivered a lot of entertainment to people back home. And George is right, it's a performance that I didn't see coming. An awful lot of people didn't see coming, but it leaves us quite heartened at what Ireland can achieve when they get things right, and they show that they can get things right. And it's the first time probably since that All Blacks game in 2018, a game where Lands End Road has probably never been louder. You know, a day that, you know, the crowd played their part. It was probably the first time since then that they've hit a level of performance. It probably wasn't quite as good as that, but it didn't need to be, because they were pretty woeful. And it gives them a nice bit of positivity to sign off with.
we'll get to some of the stories in just a moment. But George, for you covering and commentating on matches with no fans, I mean, anyone who watches Sky can hear, you can now hear Martin Tyler's breathing pattern. You can hear everything about it. The little jokes he has with Gary Neville in the background. You can hear the faint traces of a giggle there in the background. It must be quite strange that without that backtrack of fan noise, literally, people listening at home can hear everything a commentator utters.
Yes, indeed. It's utterly surreal to be in a stadium the size of the Aviva or a smaller place like Tala. It makes absolutely no difference because without the crowd, it's almost like watching a training match. It's like going along to an international session when you're allowed in for the 15 minutes or whatever it is, and just watching the players go through their paces. It's sometimes you have to remind yourself that this is actually for real. And you know, on Friday night at Tala in that match between Shamrock Rovers and St. Patrick's Athletic, there were long passages of passing that went on that you're kind of saying to yourself, you know, is this going anywhere, or are they just proving the point that they can pass the ball around? Because there has to be end product. And of course, if there'd been a crowd in there, they'd have been urging them more forward and it wouldn't have been just quite the same. There'd have been more intensity to it. But coming back to the rugby, there was certainly no lack of intensity. And I would agree with Rory how they managed to get themselves up to that pitch in an empty stadium, having had that. I must say that the anthems and Ireland's call was very, very strange on the television watching it, just how different it is. Because I always look forward to those moments in Lansdowne Road, particularly when I'm not working, say, at a rugby match, just to get into it as a spectator. It must have made them feel very flat, but somehow they managed to come out of that flatness and deliver the performance that they did. It was so, so good.
Incredible performance, really. We should get into some of the rugby stories in the back pages of the Sunday papers this afternoon. We might start with the Sunday Independent, lads. The new look Sunday Independent sports section, as I said. Brendan Fanning writing on page 2 of the sports section this afternoon. Lack of English heat allows Ireland to bask in the warm glow of victory. So no grand slam for yesterday's winners, just a slam dunk. It's a nice piece, and one of the lines that stood out for me, Jesus, where did that come from? Asked one of the broadcasting crew as they loaded up their gear in the press box. Some felt Ireland would be very competitive in a game with maybe one score between the teams. Others felt the chill you experience when it's not rain coming down but hailstones. Nobody on planet Earth saw Ireland running down the clock before Johnny Sexton called time, feeling no heat from England despite having only 13 players left on the field. Nice way of summarising the out-of-the-blue nature of this result, Rory.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think we asked all our writers to submit a preview with a short paragraph to go with it on Friday for Saturday's paper, and I think only Will Slattery predicted an Ireland win out of about 10, maybe 12 people. So a couple of the scorelines were fairly heavily weighted towards England as well. And there was a good evidence that England were on the right track when they beat France last weekend, but they couldn't back it up. And that was what was most shocking about it yesterday, especially after our first 10 minutes where England were quite dominant and Ireland were making mistakes. Bundiaki ran into touch. Ireland were making the kind of mistakes that they had made throughout this championship, and England nearly got over for that try and possibly should have had a penalty try when that maul came down over the line. And Hoje was doing what Mario Hoje often does against Ireland and looked quite dominant. And to go from that point to where they got at half time, when Johnny Sexton was able to nonchalantly kick the ball out, content at the fact that there were 14 points up and there was no more they could do before half time, was just remarkable. And even Bundiaki becomes the second player ever to get sent off for Ireland, and no one's really ever going to talk about it because there were 20 points up at the time with 20 minutes to go, and England were never going to come back from that point. So, it's good. If you turn the page to Neil Francis, he's kind of, you know, someone who has been quite critical of Andy Farrell over the last couple of years, and it hasn't been that long, but you know, he's been quite critical of the coaching team, and you know, I think everyone is doffing their cap a little bit today that they've you know, that they question where Ireland are going under this coaching ticket, but that today has given us some evidence that the things that they've been talking about throughout, and they've been adamant throughout whenever they've talked to us, they're on the right track. Johnny Sexton even said yesterday, I told you, when he came into the press conference room, you know, and he was quite characteristic, as he always is. And you know, even Frano is quite happy to say, you know, this is a sign that this team can produce under this coaching ticket. And they've given themselves a lot of breathing space now.
George, did you get into that Neil Francis piece? He starts off talking about Brexit, interestingly enough, just to twist the knife into England after that result yesterday. It's a well-written piece.
It is a well written piece, but I mean, he's always worth reading, Neil Francis, because of the different angle that he tends to come from. And I did enjoy the piece, and that was not an unexpected jibe. I mean, they were even at it on, I think it was ITV yesterday, where they referred to England as having achieved not a triple crown but a triple frown because of what had gone through the season. And you know, I think Frano hit the nail on the head. He got it absolutely right, and right because. We're at a point now with England, if we can talk about them for a moment, where we have Stuart Barnes of the Sunday Times saying it's time for Eddie Jones to go because he's run out of road. He's nothing new to bring to this England team. So, Frano's right. Why not? Why not mention Brexit when you can?
Exactly. You mentioned England there, George, and Rory, one of the ways in which Frano writes here, he talks about that Simon Easterby interview from during the week, and in the background, you could literally see Ireland performing Jack Conan's try. The exact move that led to that try. And Frano writes, if England had been watching what Ireland were doing in the warm-up, they might have figured out how to stop it. When I saw it myself, I thought, don't try that, lads. They're the sort of moves that work one time out of 100. But it was brilliantly conceived, and while Jack Conan would never be relied upon to be a front-of-house jumper, he did spectacularly well on this trick play. It's almost like not only will we beat them, we'll show them how we will beat them in advance. It's like Alex Higgins telling you he's going to pot the black off six cushions and which pocket it's going to go in. It's an embarrassment. That's on England, really.
Well, I mean, I don't think Andy Farrell told the RFU TV person to film his line-out moves on the day before the game. I think had England stopped that particular move and it had come up in the post-match that, you know, we saw that yesterday on during your interview with Simon Easterby, I think a member of the RFU media team might have been getting a 30 stint. Stinging rebuke. I mean, I've been thrown out of captain's runs for less. You know, I mean, the idea that they filmed the back line or the line-out move that won the game is a pretty remarkable faux pas. I guess it just shows that, I mean, there's so much media build-up to games now that England probably didn't have time to go through everything, and they missed Simon Easterby's 3-minute interview that was circulated at some stage on Friday. So it's just as well for whoever filmed it and released it. But yeah, I mean, like as George says, Barnes, like there's definite grumblings in the English media, and it's not really amongst the journalists, it's amongst former players and coaches. Like Clive Woodward, I interviewed him for Saturday's paper, and he made the point to me that England are better as underdogs under Eddie Jones, that the team mirrors the coach, and Eddie is a scrappy underdog from Australia, and when they produce something like the France game or the New Zealand win in the World Cup, they can't back it up a week later because they believe their own hype. And I mean, he's not quite calling for Eddie Jones to be sacked in the way that Stuart Barnes is, but he is asking, is there anyone in the RFU with the rugby knowledge or the power or the clout to hold him to account and to say to him, how the hell has it come to this? Because I was in Yokohama when they beat the All Blacks. It was probably the most complete sporting performance I've ever seen live, and that team is capable of so much more than what we saw yesterday. And he was like, his press conference was pretty uncomfortable at times yesterday. He was fairly hauled over the coals for the nature of display. I mean, Ireland did everything they could, they did it everything right, but England were woeful yesterday, and that's a pretty poor reflection on their coach and the way he stuck by all of those senior players.
Yeah, you've nicely referred to it as the last sting of a dying wasp in the Sunday Independent this afternoon. George, we have to take an ad break fairly shortly for news and weather, but any other rugby pieces that stood out to you from last night? I know there's a piece from Peter O'Reilly in the Times and one from Shane McGrath in the Irish Mail on Sunday as well.
Yeah. No, I'm just so impressed by the coverage. I mean, everybody clearly went to town on this match. The three papers that I've had a chance to go through in some kind of detail, which were the Indo, the Sunday Times, and of course the Irish Mail on Sunday, they all have a very rounded look at it. I think possibly the Times, because it's come from an English newspaper to begin with, when you see something like Stephen Jones with his piece, and I'm always interested in the other perspective. I love it when an Irish team wins and we can read all the reports and get excited about what actually happened, but it's also interesting to see it from the other side. And so I commend, you know, the Sunday Times with the Stephen Jones pieces and the Stuart Barnes piece that I referred to earlier on. Those are the two that I would suggest having a look at, because they tell it from the other side, and you can feel the pain.
Yeah, brilliant Ireland, humble England is the headline in that one. And I guess it was the last Lions run-in, the last Lions trial, really, Rory. Is like, does the Lions squad makeup or the starting 15 makeup change much as a result of what happened yesterday?
it's funny, Gavin Mayers in the Telegraph, who's an Irish journalist who works on the English beat, kind of referred to the 93 and one of the other kind of Ireland-England games at the last day of the Six Nations that based, I think it was 2017 actually, that changed the thinking of the coaches going on the tour. Mick Galway got on the tour on the basis of that 93 win. And Peter Armani played his way in 2017. So these games can have a massive impact. Eva Geegan in the Telegraph said, Hugo Keenan is his Lions bolter. Him and Ty, he described Ty Byrne as a Lions bolter as well, which I think he's long since passed being a bolter. I think he's been a shoe-in for a couple of weeks now. But definitely players like Gatland spent the week in Ireland camp. He saw their preparations. He saw the players at first hand. He was part of their bubble. He was there yesterday. I'm sure he's worried about those Saracens players and the Vinopolas. But Marco Vinopola was just nowhere near the level that he normally is. As he gave away a couple of penalties at the scrum, yeah, taken off at half time. I mean, that has to damage your credibility. And where is he going to rebuild towards the Lions tour now? He's playing in the Championship in the second tier of English rugby. One of the big questions now as well is whether Andy Farrell will go on the Lions tour and whether it's the right decision for him to be an assistant to Warren Gatland, or should he stay as part of the Ireland setup for the summer? I've been critical of the way the team has played. A few people have gone further and called for heads and things. I haven't gone that far, but yeah. I think there's been an underlying tone of people not being that impressed by the way things have gone for Farrell. So I think he deserves the credit. And I think Peter O'Reilly and the Sunday Times, him and Brendan Fanning, they look like pieces that they probably had half prepared before the game. They kind of sum up the whole tournament. They both talk about the loyalty. I think Peter says integrity, teamship, loyalty. Especially loyalty to his host senior players. These are the things that matter most for Ireland type coach. You can see it in his interviews when he's quick to speak to the team's personality traits.
Your line is just breaking up slightly there, Rory. Do you mind if we pick up that Peter O'Reilly piece just after the news? We have to take a quick break, but more on the rugby coverage straight after this news and weather ad break.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Indeed, you're very welcome back to the Sunday Paper Review here on Off the Ball. Shane Hannan with you right through until 7 o'clock this evening in for Joe Malloy. Delighted to be joined by George Hamilton, the RTE commentator and, of course, presenter on Lyric FM of the Hamilton Scores, and indeed Rory O'Connor, our guest as well on the Sunday Paper Review from the Independent News and Media, the chief rugby correspondent. Just before the ad break, sorry Rory, I interrupted you. George, you had been talking about Stephen Jones's piece on the rugby, and I guess just to round off the rugby coverage from yesterday, 32-18 win over England. Standard says farewell just as Conan steps up, but you were pointing out some of the great writing from Peter O'Reilly in the Sunday Times Irish edition this morning.
Yeah, it was both Peter and Brendan Fanning are writing about Andy Farrell, and Brendan makes a really interesting point that he's the first head coach of Ireland in the professional era who wasn't a school teacher. And Peter's writing about the way he's gone about it. He's less into the detail and the structure of the team. He's more into, he writes, integrity, teamship, loyalty, especially that of the senior players. They're the things that matter most to Ireland's head coach. You can see it from his interviews when he's quick to speak of his team's personality traits and their character rather than their technical merits or demerits. And that's a real change from what we've known with Joe Schmidt. And maybe it's part of the reason that we've seen such a struggle over the last kind of 2 years since he's taken over to try and get to grips with that, because these players have had the stabilizers taken off and they're trying to ride the bike without the help of the teacher that was there before. They've been empowered, and that empowerment has been a bit of a difficulty for them. And maybe yesterday was just the performance that they needed to kick on from here and to take ownership of the whole thing themselves.
Yeah,
what a brilliant way to put it, Rory. That was a brilliant summation. I love the stabilizers in the bike, but I think that's absolutely right, and that is what's happened. And we're going to be talking in a minute about another coach who's at the other end of the cycle, who's the subject of several pieces this weekend. And just as you're speaking, I'm thinking of what was written about Jose Mourinho by Ollie Holt in the Mail on Sunday.
Yeah,
let's get to that piece, lads, because that's an extraordinary piece of sports writing. And one that it's fair to say Jose Mourinho, if he happens to pick up a copy of the Mail today, won't enjoy reading.
I guarantee you he's already, I'd say he read, I think I saw that online about 10 o'clock last night. I'd say he'd read it by 2 minutes past 10.
he's one of those. But the headline, for anyone who hasn't seen it, page 68 of the Irish Mail on Sunday, the special one, all Tottenham have got is a dinosaur in a designer coat. And they kind of make reference to the bookmaker ad where Mourinho says it's not easy being special, and that seems to be the theme, lads, throughout this this piece by Oliver Holt. George.
It is, and he doesn't pull any punches. It's not easy being special, not easy when you think back to when you really were special, not when you know what it was like to be a king of the world, winning the big prizes with Porto, Chelsea, Inter Milan and Real Madrid, not when you must know deep down that the game has started to pass you by. And that's where Mourinho is. If I can draw attention to David Walsh's piece at the same time, he's not as critical of Mourinho. In fact, he says sacking him will not solve the greater problem for a club lacking the furniture to fill their amazing home. He begins, though, by saying, "My reservation about Jose Mourinho began on a May evening 18 years ago. It was the UEFA Cup final, Mourinho's Porto against Martin O'Neill's Celtic. And though it was a terrific game, it was also a night that diminished by the cynicism of an otherwise excellent Porto team," because he said he'd worked out that Celtic were going to be physical, so he turned Porto into a team of divers and on that night. And that's how they dismantled Celtic, by attacking the physicality of Celtic. And it was the cynicism of this that David Walsh is pointing to. And that's the kind of manager he is. But while Walsh is sympathetic to the situation in which he finds himself, Ollie Holt in the Irish Mail on Sunday is saying, "No, it's hard to argue that you're special anymore."
Like, even Robbie Fowler in the Sunday Mirror takes that sympathetic stance as well. He says, "Jose is not what he used to be, but you would be mad to write off the special one." He says the League Cup final could prove so crucial to Mourinho's future at Tottenham, albeit that's a League Cup final against Manchester City. But where are you falling down on this Jose Mourinho anger, Rory? This is, like, it's extraordinary to see so many pieces in the papers with such differing opinions on a man. But he does divide opinion.
He does, yeah. I mean, I'd start with Ollie Holt because I think it's an absolute masterclass. I've just counted them. He uses the line, "It's not easy being special," 6 times in the piece. And it's almost like a piece of poetry. He keeps coming back to it, and it kicks off another round of it's just an evisceration at every turn. And I'm struck that, I just wonder, if someone was born in 2004, what would they be? They'd be 17 now. How do you explain why Jose Mourinho is in this position to someone who doesn't remember him running down the touchline in 2004? Who doesn't remember? He was cool. Like, he was young. He was vibrant. He was like no manager we had seen. He revolutionised the game when he won the Champions League with Inter Milan, with that team that should never really have won the Champions League, with Porto, who should never win the Champions League. He was a disruptor. Before that became a kind of a fashionable tech term, and now he's just this relic. He's an advertisement for never growing old. You know, he should be forever encapsulated in that 2004 to 2008 period where he was untouchable. And he became so sour at Real Madrid. He never convinced me at United, and now he's like, why on earth would you replace Mauricio Pochettino with this man who's clearly been passed by the game? And people will point, I heard David Myler on your show yesterday saying, you know, look at what he's done in the game. But what he's done in the game is ancient history. He's a man who's just been, it's so hard to reconcile that image of him in 2004 as the game changer with where he is now.
It's funny, there are lies and damn statistics. And if you look at the statistics, it's incredible that 1 week after they started the game against Arsenal, 1 week after that, they lost at Arsenal, okay, and they got knocked out by Dinamo Zagreb, which was a dreadful result. But 2 results followed 5 straight wins, or 6 wins out of 7, which only West Ham beat them in that run. Now, I know they weren't top teams, like Wolfsburg weren't going well, Burnley, Fulham, Crystal Palace, and Zagreb at home. But all of a sudden, the lid has blown off when it seemed that he might have actually steadied the ship to some degree. But of course, I guess it's the elimination from Europe and the fact that they lost to Arsenal, and these things happened in the space of a week, that just brought it to this. There'd be somebody sitting at an editorial desk saying, "Hey, we want to consider Mourinho now after those 2 results," and maybe that's where it came from. But it's astonishing to think how it has all gone wrong. And yes, Rory, he was brand new. He was throwing his jacket into the crowd in Gelsenkirchen that night when they won the Champions League with Porto. And then he won it against all the odds. I remember I was on my way to a Champions League match at the start of that season that Inter Milan won the Champions League. And this is the effect that Mourinho had. Damien O'Mara was on the radio on the morning show and Morning Ireland. And I was speaking to him from the airport on my way to some match, first round of the Champions League. And he's group stage. And he said to me, "Okay, I'm going to put you on the spot now. Who's going to win this Champions League?" And I said Inter Milan, and the reason I'm saying that is because of Jose Mourinho. That was a decade ago, and now look how it's all fallen apart.
Yeah, Oliver Holt finishes the piece. It's not easy being special, not when scorched earth is what you leave behind at a club, not when the post-Dinamo implosion has got all the hallmarks of how it ends between you and a club. Like, it's hard to argue against some of what Oliver Holt is saying. It's you know, there's a sour taste left in the mouth from some Manchester United fans, I'd imagine. I mentioned it in the news round earlier. His treatment of someone like Luke Shaw, who now is just impressing on every level for Manchester United, is probably their player of the season, up there with Bruno Fernandes, and that attitude he has. But you saw it in the post-match interviews with Mourinho, and especially with the goalkeeper Hugo Lloris. The players aren't that happy at the moment.
No, clearly. I mean, the Joe Hart social media team aren't happy either, it seems. But I think a lot of it goes back to, I mean, I know Real Madrid was a sour experience, but the Eva Camara incident, like, that seemed to be the moment where whatever magic was there just dissipated. You know, that was so sour, so bitter, and never it left such a sour taste. And ever since then, he's just been such a, like, a relic. You know, he just doesn't, for someone who was so vibrant and so new, I don't see any new ideas with his teams. And even at one point this season, it looked like Spurs with this horrendous defensive system where Bale and Son Kane and Son, because Bale has done very little this season, would bail them out. And people were kind of going, God, they might do this because this, in this COVID season, might just suit Mourinho. And from that point, they've collapsed like everyone else apart from Man City in this kind of weird, weird season. And there's just nothing special about him anymore. He, like, where to next? I mean, Oliver Holt suggests that China is the only place he can go from here. Maybe he'd fancy a go with Portugal, and maybe he'd be suited to international football at this stage. But certainly, like, swapping a proper, vibrant, up-and-comer manager who's doing it for you, like Pochettino, for the cult of the Mourinho celebrity, looks like just such a bad decision by Daniel Levy.
Yeah, some great
One of the pieces didn't refer to it as a vanity project, really, that the appointment of Mourinho was just that. He had his stadium. He needed a manager to go with it to up the to up the profile of Tottenham Hotspur. And there was even the suggestion that this was done with one eye on America, because he was trying to get an American football team into White Hart Lane, the new stadium, on a regular basis, and that Mourinho, as the big international personality, would attract attention in the United States. So it all rather looks as if the appointment was not for football reasons, and that's the way it's unravelled.
Yeah, it's some interesting pieces around the Portuguese manager, Jose Mourinho, in the papers this morning and this afternoon. We might stick with soccer, lads, and just touch on Tommy Conlon's piece on Robbie Keane in the Sunday Independent. Bit of an awkward topic, you know. It's hard to know what to say about it, but he says, taking money for nothing shows Keane in a poor light. Former Irish captain should give back the €250,000 he has picked up for doing nothing. Not alone would it be the dignified thing to do, it would be the decent thing. And look, Tommy Conlon makes the fair point that this is not Robbie Keane's fault, that, you know, that he's picking up €250,000 for not having a job. He was involved in the previous management team under Mick McCarthy. Clearly Stephen Kenny wanted to go a different direction, brought in Damien Duff and Keith Andrews. And Keane's wage that he's picking up now is the one that's highlighted by Tommy Conlon. And he says Keane's net wealth is estimated at around €45 million. The FAI's annual accounts for 2019 showed it had net liabilities of almost €70 million, teetering on bankruptcy for years, saved in January 2020 by a combination of government bailout, UEFA money, and a restructuring of its long-term debt with Bank of Ireland. So this is an awkward one, George, in that an Irish legend, someone who was involved in the previous coaching team, and really it's not his fault that he's sitting there picking up this wage packet at the moment.
No, but I think it goes back into the unfortunate past, the immediate past of the FAI, and how things were done back then, and where we are, as the man said. And it isn't Robbie Keane's fault that this is the situation. And I don't know if it's appropriate to be suggesting how somebody should behave themselves in a circumstance that, as you say, is not of his own making. He signed up in good faith. The deal was done in good faith, and it's not his fault that he finds himself in this situation. I have sympathy for Robbie Keane in it, because it's an embarrassment. It has to be, but it's not his fault.
Yeah, Rory, this piece is an interesting one. It does just highlight a couple of the issues involved, but legally, as Tommy Conlon points out, he's entitled to his money. So was Mick McCarthy. The contracts are there in black and white. So it's a bit of an awkward one, given the esteem in which Robbie Keane is held, especially in this country, and especially now when you look at the Irish team, so lacking in goals and a goal scorer. Maybe we look back even more with rose-tinted glasses at Robbie's career, but it's a sad enough thing to have to read in the papers, I guess.
Well, yeah, it's like Robbie Keane's one of my favourite players to ever play for Ireland, and you know, he's in danger. I think he's probably in his own mind doing nothing wrong. He probably feels like he's been treated poorly by the FAI, that they should have had something sorted out for him. Like, they gave him a contract that was longer than Mick McCarthy's, which, like, it was just a crazy, the whole succession plan is an absolute mess. But I think if I was advising Robbie Keane now, and you look at the figure that Tommy puts on his overall wealth, and if I'm sure when Robbie Keane does his accounts, does he need whatever that 250k is after tax? But if he feels like he's entitled to it, but he doesn't necessarily need it, maybe some sort of grand gesture where he gives it to a local football club, or he donates it and he says, look, the FAI gave me this money, or not all of it, or some of it. I know he does charity work. Maybe he just needs to get that out there a bit more, because it does, when the FAI is in such a terrible, terrible position, I think it does look bad that he's based, especially in this current climate where, like, you know, the everything's on its head. I don't think it's a particularly good look to be withdrawing, you know, to be receiving a salary for while you're actually doing nothing. There's obviously been negotiations behind the scenes. I don't know what Robbie Keane has offered to do for the FAI for that money. I don't know if he's basically on gardening leave until the end of his contract. There's a lot we don't know. But I think there is a perception that he needs to, like, that he can manage better. And I think he could probably head pieces like Tommy Conlon's off at the pass through a couple of grand gestures that really wouldn't cost them an awful lot. And it might be a lot of money for us, but it doesn't sound like it will be a lot of money for someone who played at the top level for as long as he did. And I think in the long term, it might be a solid investment into protecting his legacy and his reputation.
Lads, we might change tack slightly to probably the story of the week. Rachel Blackmore and her performance at the Cheltenham Festival. Quite extraordinary. There is a great piece. Dennis Walsh has a piece in page 16 of the Sunday Times. It might start on the back page, Eamon Sweeney, in the Sunday Independent. Blackmore rides into history. And George, look, this is extraordinary. He mentions in the piece, he compares it to moments like Maradona in 86 and Sonny O'Sullivan winning the World Championships in 95. And lovely way of starting it. There have been Arkle Cheltenhams, Istabrak Cheltenhams, the Dawn Run Cheltenham, the Desert Orchid Cheltenham and the Denoli Cheltenham. The Rachel Blackmore Cheltenham is fit to rank alongside any of them. An extraordinary week, not just for Rachel Blackmore, but for Irish racing in general.
Yes, I mean, Cheltenham is close to the heart of anybody who follows racing in Ireland, and to perform at that level the way she did is just astonishing. And to end up as the first female to take the champion jockey title, it's just absolutely amazing. But there have been trailblazers, young women in the saddle over recent years, and I think Rachel has just delivered what was inevitably going to come. She had a wonderful string of horses to bring to victory. Of course she had. And Henry de Brom had to back it all up as well. But look, I'm astonished at how wonderfully written. I shouldn't be astonished at how wonderfully written. I'm astonished at how I reacted, not being a racing fan, to the wonderfully written piece by Eamon Sweeney, who points out towards the end of it, look at where some of the winning jockeys, owners and trainers come from. Killinall, Connor, Summerhill, Inishannon, Gowran. They're kind of places that rarely figure on the national radar, but where an awful lot of us still live. So he's saying that Irish racing is so plugged into the Irish communities, and the communities in Ireland are so plugged into Irish racing, that when something like this happens, it's even better than it otherwise would be if it was just a top jockey becoming champion jockey. Not only is she top jockey, not only is she famous, but she's one of us, is what Eamon is saying. And I think that's great. It was a truly astonishing week for Irish racing at Cheltenham. And it's just a shame that we're in the times we're in, the people there to see it.
Yeah, Rory, you probably have similar views. I mean, both pieces from Eamon Sweeney and Dennis Walsh kind of reference this breaking the glass ceiling, and how Rachel Blackmore in interviews maybe doesn't like the whole gender question, but it inevitably comes up that, you know, she is creating history and she's inspiring young girls across Ireland, young boys as well. But it's hard to ignore that angle to this, as much as she would like to, I guess.
Yeah, especially on a, you know, when you're writing for a Sunday paper, when you know, Rachel Blackmore's done a number of interviews over the course of the week, and the whole thing has been covered from every single angle, you are looking for, you know, different ways of coming at it. So I'm sure that played a role in it as well. And I found, like, racing isn't my thing, and usually I get sucked a little bit into Cheltenham because I'd be in the office and people will be watching it and talking about it. this year I was at home and it passed me by, and really my only interactions with it were through Rachel, because I listened to her interview and off the ball, I you couldn't help it, Twitter lit up whenever she won the big races. And I thought the nicest line in Amos Sweeney's piece was where he said, from a personal point of view, I witnessed two women in my family separated by almost 70 years of age rooting for Blackmore in the way they never would for a male jockey. They knew what her performance meant and they reveled in it. And for all the good PR from stuff like 20 for 20 campaign and all that sort of stuff, this sort of success and someone forcing themselves onto the back pages and into the news cycle and on through their own performances and their own success is just going to do far more than any PR campaign can, because it's incredibly merited and it's incredible to see someone pushing those boundaries so much.
We have a lot more pieces to get through and we're tight enough on time, but I guess we'll stick with another top Irish female athlete. I know this is a piece I did not get the chance to read, Rory, but the piece on Christina Desmond, Mark Gallagher, I think, has it in the papers this morning. Yeah. You wanted to touch on that one.
Yeah, it's a horrible COVID story in some ways. Christina Desmond, not someone I was hugely aware of, boxing, again, isn't really my sport, but Mark Gallagher always... every Sunday seems to deliver, delve into the Irish sporting landscape and come up with interesting stories he's very good at that. And Christina Desmond had hopes of going to Tokyo this year, but her qualification tournament was cancelled because of COVID. And as a result, her Olympics is gone. And she narrowly missed out 4 years ago, or 5 years ago now, on Rio. And she's now looking at 3 years' time in Paris because there's no way of her getting to Tokyo. And it's just incredibly, dispiriting to have that take, whatever about not making it because you didn't qualify, to have that taken away from you on, outside of your own terms is really, really unfortunate. And even the day she found out that the qualification tournament was cancelled, she said it wasn't on her radar, there was no rumours. She's a guard and she was a close contact of someone who had a COVID case and she was isolating. So she got a phone call from Bernard Dunn to tell her, look, this is not happening. So she then had to deal with that news while sitting in her spare room and not able to interact with anyone or get a hug or any of the things that you would normally do after that. And it's a horrible COVID story, but she's quite resilient and she's asked, would you turn pro? But her dream has always been, to be an Olympian, and she's determined to make it there in 3 years time. But it's not the longest read in the papers today, but it's a story that I didn't know about before I came in. And that's, I suppose, what you're looking for sometimes when you're turned into the papers. And, I'll certainly be looking out for her now after this, as she hopefully goes towards Paris, because God, to have that taken away from you when you've worked so hard towards it must be so difficult.
Yeah, can't be easy. I know, George, you covered the women's hockey team last week at the SoftCo series.
Weekend, yeah.
And it's the same for them. I'll be chatting to Chloe Watkins and Katie Mullen on the show later, and we'll no doubt touch on that, but it must be so difficult for these players. We remember that night in Donnybrook when they qualified for the Olympics and made history at the end of 2019, and then to wait to the following summer and to see it cancelled, and now to have to wait until July this year, and invariably with no fans. It must be so difficult.
No hockey for so long as well, which was the point that they were all making up in Belfast last week. That it was hard to keep motivated and keep fit and keep training and keep focused on the goal that was still there, even though it had been pushed back 12 months. I thought they were absolutely. I know this is not slightly off the subject. We're not talking about that in the papers today, but they were wonderful last weekend. They beat GB for the first time ever, and they ended the series all square. Remarkable. That is one of the stories of the week.
Yeah, win, a draw, and a defeat. Not a bad way to spend those 4 days up in Belfast for the Irish women's hockey team. So congratulations to them. Lads, I want to touch on this extraordinary piece in the middle of the Sunday Independent sports section on the Maher family. Dermot Crowe has this piece on the Laois, formerly Laois footballer Colin Maher. And I have to hold my hands up. I honestly hadn't been aware of this story. And Colin and a number of members of his family, a very large family has to be said, lost in a house fire, and extremely emotional piece. Just to give people the context here, 25 years after tragedy struck the Maher family, memories remain vivid of how Port Arlington rallied around in support of their own. And a lovely photo of some of the Maher family today. But it says, in 1996, clubs met in the county final, St Joseph's winning this time, but their world had irrevocably changed. In June, Colin Maher died after a house fire that also killed his mother, two of his brothers and three sisters. The eldest of 11, he died trying to save members of his family, heading back into the flames. He survived for a few days with severe burns before dying on June 5th, aged 27. this is an extraordinary piece. I was too young at the time to remember this in the news. And Colm, I'm 27 myself, so same age as Colm, and this is harrowing. And they mention the names in the piece as well. Alomar, 48, and his sons Vincent, 17, and Dominic, 11, survived the fire, but different members of the family passed away, and this is extraordinary. Six of the family laid to rest in one day in Port Arlington, and then 2 days later, Colm Maher's funeral took place. Really, really deep and emotional piece. I don't know which of you has had the chance to read this.
I was extremely touched by that. Like you, I wasn't fully aware of it. It's something that had passed by in the off season of the GAA. That you know that something like this had happened, and I hadn't remembered the tragedy. I really don't know why, but the piece was powerful, really, really powerful, very emotional, as you say. I mean, to read of a funeral, you know, we forget what funerals are like at this time because of the conditions that we're living in at the moment. But the local curate, PJ Byrne, hailing the footballer's courage at his funeral mass. When you picture Colm's last moments, scripture comes alive. No greater love can a man have than to lay down his life for his brother. I mean, that sums up what the piece was about, really. The tragedy struck, and he tried to defeat the tragedy and lost his life in the process, and so did several other members of the family. Awful, awful story, but so beautifully, beautifully recalled, and I think very well done to Dermot Crowe for doing that, and the Sunday Independent for bringing it to light on this anniversary, because it's just such an awful story and a reminder of how fragile life actually is.
Yeah, Mark Condren, I know you touched on it, Shane, but Mark Condren's photograph is stunning. You know, it captures the sun just before it drops behind the buildings, behind the local GA club pitch in Port Arlington, and the three men who were touched by the tragedy, and a boy, Colm, who was named after the subject of the piece, looking kind of away from the camera, and you know. Then there's also a little picture from the inside the clubhouse, I presume, of Colm's jersey, and the kind of tribute you'd see in any clubhouse and any sport across the country. It's really powerful. The whole thing is really powerful. Like you guys, I don't remember this happening, and there's so much about the strength of the club and how the local community rallied around, and the importance of, maybe, you know, there's probably pieces we won't get to today due to time, but you know, there's a lot of talk in the papers about the fact that sport isn't going on at the moment in communities, and this just shows the importance that this local sporting club had for its community and that family, and raising money to help them rebuild their house. And they went back and lived at the same site where their family died. I mean, I can't even imagine how they went and did that, but they did, thanks to the support of their local community and their local club. It's really, really, really powerful.
Yeah, an extraordinary piece. And they even say, we tried a bit of counselling, says Paul, of the time after the tragedy. We sat in front of a counsellor. There were the five of us there, and he said, I actually don't know what to say. He was a grief counsellor and did two sessions, and kind of sums up the gravity and size of that tragedy for the family. You can only imagine what it must have been like at the time to lose so many members of your family. It kind of leads in a little bit. I wanted to mention Mario Rosenstock's piece as well, two pages down in the Sunday Independent. I've been thinking a lot about Dadat, his grandfather. I wonder what he would have made of this strange year. And he talks about it highlights the links of between sport and members of your family. And he says, Gamma always insisted that I use good diction and speak well, sometimes too well. Aged 7 on one of my first, what we would now call, play dates with Tom, a boy from my class, I stood up at the dinner table and ventured, Mrs. Brown, may I be permitted to use the lavatory? And he talks about the relationship between his grandfather and himself. This was another nice piece, lads, that I guess we've all had this. Malachy Clerken was writing in the Irish Times yesterday, I think it was, about the relationship he had with his father, and you know, who passed away 5 or 6 years ago, and his obsession with gardening in his later years, and wondering what he would make of this whole COVID thing. But I guess the last year or so has got us all thinking more inwardly about death and about life and about all of these things.
Yeah, and then there's definitely a hint of melancholy running through a lot of today's pieces. I mean, Joe Brolly's gone back to school, as he writes about Marvin Hagler, and has some great stories. You know, Colm O'Rourke is talking about, you know, greats of the Cavan GA scene Colm O'Rourke is talking about the greats of the Cavan GA scene have passed, and you know, in the last year. And I guess that's just the world we're living in, and where people's heads are at, especially the GA writers who have no sport to cover at the moment, and are writing columns based on the sport that isn't there. But yeah, Mario Rosenstock's piece is really, touching and unusual in it, you know, it's in a good way, you know, it's different, and I mean, you're looking for different stuff as you read it, and it's a lovely different tale, and it kind of I mean, I watched Mario Rostock do a gift group the other day where they were just throwing names at him, and he was able to flip into them straight away. And the way is, I just can't comprehend how his brain works. But I think you get a sense of the child that became that man in the piece as well. So it's lovely. It's very personal and quite touching as well. And the kind of the way he consumed sport as a child and the magic that was there. And I wonder, you know, the names that his grandfather kind of raised them on, and you know they wouldn't be on TV as frequently as kids now who are lucky enough to have Sky Sports and BT. There's football on every night, whereas these are fleeting glimpses at these legends. And I wonder, has the myth of players been busted a little bit by the fact that we see them all the time and they're available on YouTube? But no, it's really nice. It's a really nice piece, and with some lovely imagery as well.
I might just go on, George.
Sorry, I was just going to say it's a sucker for an insight into people's lives, and particularly into the childhood that they would have had. Dadad and I watched everything together. Eamon Coughlin's wretched Olympics fourth place again, this time of AIF to the Shifter, who was rumoured to be in his late 40s at the time. And another local hero, John Tracy from Villierstown, winner of the World Cross Country Championship in Limerick, covered itself at the time. What was to be reassuringly like over the other stuff. And he talks about sitting on his grandfather's knee at the age of 12, watching the World Cup and the players that he names Tigan Aruminiga, Litbarski, as Jimmy McGee, referring to Horst Skubesh as the monster, you know. And still a 12-year-old kid sitting on his grandfather's knee in 1982. Simple times, a simple past, and lovely to have it recalled like that in the time that we're in. But a time when family is so important because of what isn't there.
Yeah, I spoke to a friend quite recently who lost his father quite suddenly about a year or so ago, and he talked about you know, watching football with his dad was routine, was what was normal, and then, you know, once someone like that passes away, you turn to your right or wherever they were sitting in their normal spot in the living room, and they're not there. It kind of sport then almost makes it more painful that was an experience you shared together, and Mario Rosenstock clearly has got to the point now where he can write about that and his memories of his grandfather, which is it's a lovely piece, it has to be said. And similarly, Paul Kimmage's diaries piece in the Sunday Independent as well, where he's talking about, you know, reflecting and looking back and taking notes. Another interesting piece as well, I thought, that you know, reflecting back on his career and having that, I guess, freedom of thought. I don't know if you lads keep diaries or keep notes or that sort of thing, but like at the start of lockdown last year, I started to do a bit of record, you know, chatting to your family at home, record the small moments, I guess, and maybe even write some stuff down in diaries. And I think in a number of years' time, we look back and think, you know, what did we think of that whole thing? So maybe if people are considering writing diaries, now would be a good time to start.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think of the late British politician, Anthony Wedgwood Benn, who was renowned as one of the great diarists of all, and how he did his diary. He was a teetotaler who drank too much tea, believe it or not. But he, when he went to bed every night, would write his diary, write what had happened that day, because the contemporaneous account was the much more valid account than what you might recall 5-10 years later, even 5 or 10 weeks later. And that's why politics may not be your thing, particularly English politics, but for diaries, the stuff that Tony Wedgwood Benn wrote is brilliant. And it's because he did it there and then, and it was a diary. And so I couldn't agree with you more, Shane. I think it's a great idea, and I'd encourage anybody to keep notes, even if not formal writing.
Absolutely. Lads, we're out of time. There's so many pieces we could have got into and just didn't have time. There's a great piece by Dennis Walsh in the Sunday Times on GAA memorabilia. Shane McGrath writes on Air Sports' Uncertain Future as well, and the importance of terrestrial TV coverage. You mentioned Colm O'Rourke's piece and Joe Brawley's piece on marvellous Marvin Hagler and comparisons to Derry's Henry Diamond. So some really great pieces there. Big interview with Rafa Benitez as well in the Times. And then Stephen Kenny, there's always the pieces on Stephen Kenny and the big calls he has to make this week. Philip Quinn is writing in the Irish Mail on Sunday. Piece on Peter Lorimer, the late Peter Lorimer, Leeds legend, in the Irish Mail on Sunday as well. We mentioned Oliver Holt going in heavy on Jose Mourinho and loads of good pieces as well. Cora Staunton, Sean McGoldrick writing about her in the Independent. Michael Foley in the Times writing about the Clare GAA board issues. So loads of great pieces to get into in the Sunday papers. But lads, it's been a pleasure combing through the back pages with you both this afternoon. George
Thank
Hamilton and Rory O'Connor, thanks a million, and no doubt we'll speak to you again soon.
Thank you, George.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.